It is September 14th, 9:15 in the morning.
This is Kim Schaefer with Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Donna Norman is also connected by phone from the commission, and we're here to interview Michael Raines and his attorneys are Ike Sorkin and
Dan Roque.
Which is spelled R-O-Q-U-E. And
Michael Berger from Paul Weiss, B-E-R-G-E-R.
And we're from Dick's, Mr. Raines' attorneys are from Dickstein Shapiro.
Thank you. And Michael, if you don't mind.
Michael Raines.
And do you consent to
consent.
Having this taped?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. We did interview you before and have a record of your biography, but if you would, just for clarity, state your title at Citi, the years you were there, and also your title at Deutsche Bank.
Sure. I was at Citi. My start date, I believe, was June 2006, and I left in October 2007, and at Citi I was head of global structured credit, and prior to that I was at Deutsche Bank, and I was at Deutsche Bank when I left Deutsche Bank I was global co-head of securitization and head of CDOs, and I was at Deutsche Bank for a little over 5 years. So I started March, I think March of 2000. Maybe it was there 6 years. No, 5 years. It's been so long.
Close enough.
Okay.
Thank you. If you would clarify for me, please, both at Deutsche Bank and at Citi, that your responsibilities included corporate credit and not just mortgage-related and CDO credit. Is that correct?
No, at Deutsche, I had I did not have any responsibility for corporate credit. I was, my background was 100% securitization, and I had my whole career was in securitization, and then when CDOs started to grow and there were some political changes at Deutsche in terms of responsibility, I took on additional responsibility for CDOs, but that did not include a Deutsche Bank corporate credit.
So it did not include CSOs?
It did not include CSOs or single name trading.
Okay.
Citigroup, I was hired in this new role as head of structured credit. And that was primarily CDOs, but in addition to that, it was the CDOs of single-name corporate credits, single-name default swaps. So it did include CSOs as well as CDOs. It did not include the trading of the underlying corporate credits or the trading of the underlying ABS. Which was slightly different than at Deutsche. I had responsibility for both the underlying ABS as well as the CDOs. So it was a different job at Citi versus Deutsche. Does that make sense?
Yes. So if I could paraphrase, at Citi, it was really all structured products.
Correct.
Whereas at Deutsche Bank, it was I'm tempted to say all securitized products. That's not fair. All ABS and CDO related.
Correct.
Okay. That's actually quite helpful. What in the commission's charge to explain what happened and why, there are developments in interplay between the underlying markets and the CDO market and the development of derivatives and how that fed perhaps increased the bubble depending on your perspective, perhaps helped burst the bubble depending on your perspective.
Sure.
So a lot of the questions that I have written down here to ask you are really more about your opinion and your experience as you've been advised before about the commission. You're not supposed to tell us something that's untrue, but and I have no reason to believe that you would, but I do recognize that much of what I'm asking is really your opinion based on your experience. So there's some question, if you will, of sort of like where do we start? If you have a starting point that you'd like to start with in talking about the development of these markets and how you think they grew and why, then we can start there.
I'd be curious to get your, you were, when did you leave Bear Stearns?
When it died,
June 08. So we can start what you think, and then I can say what I think.
Well, we can all start with by saying, and end this quickly, it was Bush and deregulation, and end this and go home. How's that sound? Go ahead.
I'm staff, so my
she's gotta ask the question
my the, it, so I'm supposed to ask questions,
right, okay.
And I'll venture this on the record that the reason I'm doing this is because I wonder.
Right.
I have questions. Having lived it, I have questions.
Right.
How did this all develop and grow so big and ultimately so toxic?
Right.
And why?
I thought a lot about it, you know, when I left Citi, and frankly, I haven't thought a lot about it over the last 3 years. But there are a couple things that I find interesting. One is that I spent 5 years in London when I was at Deutsche Bank, so I have a very keen recollection. When I left the securitization market, at that point I was just responsible for European securitization. I worked at Deutsche for 6 years. Five of the six I was in London, responsible for the European business. And I remember coming back to the U.S. after, and at that point I was still at Deutsche Bank, but I was promoted to co-head global, so I had European as well as U.S. and Asian responsibility. And clearly, within that five-year period of time, I saw a remarkable change in terms of the securitization market, where I grew up really starting with revolving transactions like credit cards. That's how I grew up in the business. I was first a lawyer, and then I worked on credit card securitizations. And credit card securitizations, I'm sure you remember, that was the largest asset class at a certain point. And, you know, I saw, coming back, and I remember going to the conferences and the big industry conferences, which I'm sure you've attended, the tone of the market and the kind of climate of the market remarkably changed, where I saw these mortgage securitizers and originators be the most important clients versus when I left 5 years prior, and it was all the big credit card issuers who had gotten purchased by other credit card issuers.
To your recollection, when did that shift occur, in 03, 04, or later?
Well, I was
that?
Gone between 01 and 05. So, and I really was gone. So I was living in London, and I didn't go to the industry conferences.
I see.
I can't give you an exact time. I just remember commenting to the person I reported to at Deutsche Bank, you know, this really has changed pretty dramatically. And not in a negative way. It was just, you know, the market has changed. I personally don't think that, and as a background, I grew up in securitization. I was originally a lawyer, Cravath. I worked on the first credit card deals in the 90s. My professional career really was built on securitization. So I understood the benefits of securitization. And I wasn't just drinking the Kool-Aid. I really did believe it was a viable financing tool which would allow issuers that were not AAA credits access the capital markets. And, you know, clearly there was growth before I got into the market, which was the mortgage market in the 70s and 80s, that propelled the way for non-mortgage assets, non-prime mortgage assets like credit cards. You know, I worked on the first credit card deal for Federated Department Stores when they were, I don't know if you remember that, but when they were in bankruptcy, they securitized their credit card assets and were able to get a AAA credit card deal. And yeah, that was, do you remember that deal? It was 10, 12 years ago, but it was a testament to when securitizations work well, and unfortunately people think so negatively of securitizations and subprime and what happened, but there was significant benefits to the technology which enabled, and the capital markets which enabled issuers that were not AAA credits to access this capital base. So I don't believe that securitization and the growth of derivatives are the culprits, if you will, because clearly there are, and part of your report is trying to draw, you know, what happened and conclusions.
Yes.
But in my opinion, I don't believe it was the growth of either of those markets that led to the crisis. I think that they were both, you know, for lack of a better term, derivatives of the problem, not the problem in and of itself. I think the problem in and of itself was the poorly underwritten and, you know, it's not for me to say because I wasn't, you know, especially at Citigroup, I wasn't on kind of the front line of what was being underwritten at that time, but I think that the technology was abused inappropriately looking back, and obviously loans that should not have been underwritten in the first place were then fed into this machine, which was a very powerful and very, you know, very credible machine, which was the securitization and then CDOs. And CDOs and securitization, I think, are so linked that you almost can't separate one from the other. It's the same technology, just another derivation of the same technology. That I don't believe that that's what caused the problem. I think what the problem was based in that underlying asset, which was an asset that was inappropriately underwritten and inappropriately, you know, I don't know if fraud is the right word, but there were issues in terms of how those assets were underwritten. And when you have something that's not what it is communicated to be, and then you securitize it, then the problem just becomes more magnified. But if you didn't have that problem, you didn't have that asset that was tainted, then you wouldn't have had the issues that grew out of that problem.
Just so we have a clear record, when you say assets, you mean mortgages?
I mean mortgages, correct.
Okay. And you probably mean, but maybe not, subprime and Alt-A mortgages.
Subprime and Alt-A. I mean, they're all, I guess I think of them all together, so subprime and Alt-A.
Okay.
I mean, there was a distinction that the market developed in terms of subprime versus Alt-A, but at the end of the day, they were both what I would say inappropriately underwritten looking back, and you had issues with that underwriting process that then were securitized in the first place and then securitized in the second order, which were the CDOs, which caused the issues. And what I and that's my opinion, that that's the real issue. And clearly there were a number of parties that were involved in that poor asset, meaning the mortgage originators, the mortgage brokers, the rating agencies, the underwriters of those assets, the investors in those assets. I mean, there clearly were a number of parties, and those assets, again, being the core asset, the mortgage loan, that started this domino process that led to, that, you know, lent itself to the, you know, what happened with a number of the banks, with, you know, the second order securitization, which were the CDOs.
So some people are of the view that, you know, building on your starting point, some people are of the view that when CDOs were developed and became focused primarily on mortgages, because first you had multi-sector, and then there was a shift from multi-sector CDOs to more subprime-focused CDOs, that the demand that created demand for the subordinate pieces of the subprime securities, and so the ease of placement of those subprimes, of the subordinate tranches of subprime into ABS CDOs fueled the greater growth of the subprime origination market, because what had been perhaps more difficult to place or more expensive to place in earlier years in the 2000s were suddenly much easier and faster to place.
I mean, it's a good question. I don't know, you know, the demand from investors for lower tranches then fuel the origination of kind of that asset. It's hard to say. I mean, I will tell you, if you look at other growth, which I think is an interesting numbers to take a look at, like for credit card securitizations, it's a great example. You know, credit card securitizations, the original ones were just AAA, and, you know, that fueled, you know, those deals fueled banks like Capital One and all the regional banks to offer credit cards under the Visa monogram. And banks that were not highly rated were able to access securitization cost of funds. And there are a number of success stories where you know, securitization there, you know, helped all those banks and helped the consumer by offering incredibly aggressive rates for those credit card assets. And those were the days when you would get 10 different pre-approved mailings. And the market, like any market where you have an immature market and then becomes more mature, they were, a lot of those banks who became very successful were then bought out by, you know, the MBNAs were bought out by, I believe, Chase, and Barclays bought a number of the banks. And so their securitization and selling down the capital structure enabled businesses to grow in a very efficient way and reach a kind of more normal maturation. And it wasn't, for whatever reason, that in that life cycle didn't lead to anything close to the same issues we're dealing with, the life cycle of subprime mortgages that accessed the securitization market and enabled securitizations to tap down the capital structure. Because it's the same history. When you think of the 90s with all those banks issuing credit card paper, and I don't know if you remember, there was a big development of issuing the C pieces, which were below investment grade. So that history was not that dissimilar and helped the industry and helped the consumer and didn't lead to the same...
Sorry, I'm not as familiar with credit cards. Clearly not as familiar as you are. The subordinate pieces of credit cards started first were not issued,
right,
and then became were issued, and there a market for them developed.
Correct.
And investors did lots of credit analysis based on lots of data, presumably of the performance of these credit card issuers.
Specifically, what happened was what they were called in credit card lingo, there was A pieces, B pieces, and C pieces. And the A pieces were typically AAA down to double A, you know, triple A, double A, but mostly triple A. The B pieces were the single A. And then anything below the single A was either retained by the issuer, and that was, you know, by highly rated institutions like a Citigroup or Chase, where it didn't make sense. They were getting funding at cheaper levels than any other market participant. But with lower rated corporate sellers, like Capital One, where it would cost, their cost of funds would be higher than anything they could achieve in the capital markets, they would privately place the C pieces, which were typically rated triple B or below, with banks, with bank conduits. That was in the 90s. And then what happened, which is not unusual in the maturation of any capital market structure, those C pieces started to be offered because there was investor demand, and they were the spread was significant versus any other triple B piece, you know, looking at the loan market or the corporate market, that there was a benefit ascribed to a structured asset that was rated triple B. And that grew into a very vibrant market away from the traditional bank private market. And then, you know, not unusual, there were, within credit card structures, you know, below that triple B, that was then offered to certain investors who liked the risk reward of taking, you know, first loss or second loss on that asset stream, and that became its own market as well. So I think that's something to look at. That, you know, here securitization, here being the credit card history, was not that dissimilar. It was the number one asset class for years. It propelled that industry. You could argue whether that was good or bad for society or for the consumer. It clearly helped the consumer become more levered because, you know, and again, you could argue that was not a societal good for the economy, but it didn't lead to the economic crisis or the financial crisis that this other asset class created. And so therefore, in my opinion, the conclusion I take just from that analogy is that there has to be something in that asset class, meaning subprime mortgages, that started the process that was very different than the credit card asset class.
Let's just follow that through for a minute. Very interesting point, and we appreciate your bringing the depth of your experience to bear on this. Presumably, then, again, revealing my lack of following cards in particular, is those C pieces of certain recent vintages are probably underwater and losing money because default rates are higher.
The credit cards?
Yeah, than had been historically the case for a decade or so.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose a difference one could draw is that those C pieces were not then themselves securitized and levered up again. So the C piece is essentially analogous to the triple, as you were suggesting, to the triple B piece of subprime, to the extent there were outlets, ready demand of whatever sort for those triple B pieces in a market that had matured.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed for greater growth both of the credit card market and of the subprime market. But where there becomes a disconnect between the two is, if my understanding is correct, that the credit card C pieces weren't, again, securitized.
They were.
Oh, they were.
Yeah. We had D1
okay.
and D2 pieces.
Okay.
So they were securitized. I mean,
And what sort of rating would you get? 70%
double
triple
B,
A?
They were below investment grade.
Oh.
Below investment grade. Now, were those assets put into... Is your question, were those assets put into CDOs?
No, actually not, although that would be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I worked on a couple... I mean, it wasn't the same magnitude, clearly, as in the mortgage sector, but that's where... That was a very important piece of the exercise for the issuers, because they were funding anything below what they sold on the balance sheet. So it was an economic analysis that if you had a lower rated seller servicer, and I keep using Capital One because I think it was referred to in those days as a monoline, right? So they were only credit card issuers. That if their cost of funds in the unsecured market, you know, was wherever BBB or below, they were probably a low BBB or maybe even a BB plus corporate credit. If they could achieve a lower cost of funds by accessing the capital markets, and there was indeed a capital markets investor base for that piece of paper, they would do an economic analysis of whether or not it would be worth selling down below investment grade. You didn't see that with the Cities or the Chases or, you know, a lot of the regional banks, Comerica and Wachovia and Wells Fargo, who had, you know, much cheaper cost of funds, but you saw that with other seller servicers who had done the economic analysis and could raise cheaper cost of funds below the investment grade rating.
Okay, so just to clarify, the C pieces were generally rated BBB or were generally rated below investment grade?
The C pieces were generally rated BBB, but then there was another layer below the BBB that was a D piece. And that D piece, you know, I remember a couple of deals where we did one for when I was at First Boston actually at this time, so I was at First Boston before Deutsche Bank. Where we carved out a D1 and a D2. That was with Leslie, actually. So it was, you know, responding to investor demand, that there was an investor or investor base that would, you know, take that lower piece and be rewarded for it with a higher coupon.
Okay, but I still want to focus on the triple B. So
right.
The C piece... Were those securitized again?
Yes. Were they securitized again? They were securitized, meaning they were part of originally the BBB was retained by the issuer.
Right.
And or they were sold to a private bank consortium. They weren't sold through a public offering or even a 144A offering. There was a significant market, which were typically the European conduits, who bought that BBB piece prior to selling that BBB piece to the capital markets. And the way that was done was getting an explicit rating, and the first was Fitch, who rated those BBB pieces, and then Moody's and S&P followed suit, and having the rating clearly helped in the marketability of that C piece. And then that became an active market, which was a new issue market and a secondary traded market.
Right.
Does that make sense? It
completely makes sense.
Okay.
It just, again, for my analogy, in the subprime market, it was the triple Bs that went into the MES CDOs as a second order securitization.
Right.
So, and one question from certain viewpoints is, and I think regulators actually are largely taking this view now, that maybe securitization is okay, but the second order securitization is when you get into trouble. And so that was not done really in the, or certainly not in size, in the credit card.
Right. No, I think that's right. The issue, though, with credit card securitizations, they dried up because there only became two issuers. Everyone bought everyone else. So if you look at the industry, there were 40 issuers in the 90s or even more, and then there was significant consolidation in the industry. So there were very few standalone issuers of credit card securitizations.
I see. Okay. All right. Interesting analogy on credit cards. I don't want to spend too much time directly. Sorry, maybe it's easier if I just walk through these questions.
Sure.
That I have written down, and those that you feel are less appropriate to your background, just we can skip.
Okay.
So some of these questions are really designed to understand how derivatives fueled or did not fuel the market.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sort of testing hypotheses, if you will. So we're drawing on both your Deutsche Bank and your Citi general market experience.
Mm-hmm.
Various forms of mortgage credit derivatives developed, was that significantly used in your experience for hedging mortgage warehouses, for hedging CDO warehouses? Some people have commented that without derivatives, without the ability to hedge, there's less credit creation. So you sort of start with the warehouse function, and was the ability to hedge through mortgage credit derivatives important for expanding that those businesses? Both in mortgages and CDOs, if my question is clear.
I mean, I think, well, first of all, my opinion is that derivatives are a good thing, not a bad thing. So, you know, I'm coming with that premise because, you know, I'm a believer in market efficiency, that a more efficient market is better than a less efficient market. And derivatives, the advent of derivatives enable you, you know, they obviously, the mortgage and now they're driven on leveraged loans, as I'm sure you know, that, you know, what derivatives on corporate credits allow two market participants to take a view on a particular credit without waiting for liquidity or issuance or size constraints that a traditional cash bond issue is limited by. So, you know, if you and I are two market participants and you believe that IBM credit should, you know, is worth X, and I believe IBM credit is worth Y, the market should lead to, you know, a value for what the two market participants who may have opposing views will be worth, as opposed to if you're IBM and you're issuing whatever IBM's rated, I don't even know what IBM's rated, AA, and are there any other AAA issuers left, that you have to wait for the IBM is announcing a bond deal. It's going to be next month. It's going to be $150 million in size. You know, take your orders here. Here are the underwriters involved in the deal. Whether or not they do a good underwriting and marketing, that will now be where IBM bond spreads trade at, i.e., what the quote-unquote IBM credit is worth. And, you know, clearly there's a disparity between the cash market and the synthetic market, but what a derivative allows you to do is take all of that noise away. Again, I think it's built on efficiency, and come up with a price, which happens to be an insurance premium, for what market participants believe. So I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, I think that the premise is a very good one, and there's significant history of where that has led to, you know, efficient pricing, but just like other markets, there are inefficiencies because a market is built on market participants.
All right. I'm asking two open-ended questions,
okay.
and I, for time reasons, should try to shift to
okay.
More precise questions.
Okay.
In your experience, did the development of credit derivatives facilitate better or cheaper hedging of mortgage origination or CDO origination?
It facilitated, in my opinion, it facilitated hedging, you know, kind of on both fronts. I got to think how I would answer that. Were the two, say
in,
it again?
For mortgage origination.
Right.
And for ABS CDO origination. You had been in a situation where there were at least less precise or more expensive ways to hedge. You suddenly had, perhaps suddenly, you
right.
had more tools to hedge your book.
Right.
Is it your view that those tools were used and was part of the greater origination of mortgages, greater origination of CDOs, because dealers could reduce their warehouse risk, so they're willing to open more warehouses?
Right. No, I believe that was one of the factors. I wouldn't say it's the only or the primary factor for the growth, but I believe that it was a helpful contributing factor to the growth of both markets.
Okay, thank you. Do you have a sense that this may be more from Deutsche Bank, maybe not? What percent, roughly, what proportion of triple B subprime mortgage-backed securities ended up in CDOs, and that may well have shifted over time or at different institutions, but is there any way to cuff your view of the proportion?
Of CDOs backed by triple B mortgages?
How much of the triple B subprime paper that was created ended up in CDOs as opposed to being purchased by other investors?
I can't guess on that one. I don't have it. It's hard because for me to answer that, because when I was at Deutsche, I really was not involved in the mortgage because I was in
okay.
Europe. And then at
okay.
Citi, I didn't have responsibility for
okay.
the
and I knew I might hit some questions that... But let me try in a slightly different way. Did you have any sense during those years that the development of the ABS CDO market changed the subprime market? Or Alt-A?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that the growth of the ABS CDO market had an impact on the underlying mortgage market. I mean, there's no question that was, you know, ABS CDOs became an important factor in terms of purchasing the underlying credits. So they were highly correlated. They weren't. The two markets were not working in isolation. There was, the ABS CDOs became, I don't know what the numbers are, but became a large buyer of the underlying triple B assets.
So maybe it was 80%. Maybe it was 50%.
It was significant. I can't quantify it, but that I would think that there's good research on that.
There are various folks trying to
right.
do that research, but it's actually quite an undertaking.
Did you look at Deutsche Bank's research, Karen
market.
Weaver's research?
We have looked at some, but okay. I don't know that she had access to the whole, sort of to the whole market.
Okay.
So there are opinions about this, but there's less.
And no one really kind of
really thorough.
Oh, really?
Research. Similar question as we step through to CDOs. Do you have a sense of, for the triple B CDO tranches, do you have a sense of what proportion of those ended up in other CDOs or CDO squares?
You're talking just Citigroup or the entire universe?
I'm inviting Michael to comment on either.
My sense is that less than the first, I guess the triple B mortgages going into triple B CDOs, say that, I don't know what that number is, say that's 50%. Then the triple B CDO is going to CDO squared.
Or other CDOs.
I don't have it. My guess is it would be less than that, but that's a hard one to, I guess your question is, was there an independent market that developed outside of the CDO market to buy other CDOs? And on the first kind of derivation, yes. On the second derivation, my recollection is that there was still a market for that paper that were outside of the other CDOs buying CDO paper. I mean, clearly it was a part, it was an investor base within the market, but it wasn't 90% investor base.
Okay.
But that's, it's obviously something that.
Again, it's harder to.
Keep going, I have to check something.
Okay.
Some of this is harder to track and to really quantify than one might expect.
It's also hard because, there were conduits and other vehicles that were buying both pieces of paper and what's technically a CDO and a conduit. And, like in any capital markets, especially structured credit, it's, which is what caught one of the reasons that the impact was so varied and broad was because the pockets, the end pocket was not always crystal clear.
Again, I'm just asking for your sense and recollection.
Yeah.
What proportion of AAA ABS CDO tranches ended up being done through negative basis trades?
I don't have a good sense on that, I'm sorry.
Okay. Trading of CDOs was under your domain at Citi. Did that become a large market, significant revenue, and was it all parts of the CDO capital structure that were traded?
Yes. I mean, it was an important part of the overall business, and it was an important part to help in price discovery for the new issue business. So they were highly correlated, both from a business standpoint and from a revenue standpoint, because it was I believe, and that was under Nestor, because the new issue and trading had to have had to sit right next to each other, in my opinion.
And there is trading in triple A's as well.
There, before the market became liquid.
Yes.
There was trading across the capital structures, is my memory.
And was there much If I should just ask Nestor, it's fine. Was there much CDS on CDO tranches?
I believe that was part of the. I mean, clearly that was in the trading domain to trade the underlying, you know, cash tranches as well as CDS on CDO tranches, both from a trading perspective and also from a hedging perspective. So that was part of the overall business.
And was that, so would that have been part of his CDO business, or was that part of, now we're focused on Citi,
right,
on correlation trading in a different desk?
No, that was part of the way that Citi's the structure was established at Citi. Nestor had responsibility for the new issue business as well as the secondary trading business, which included cash and synthetic secondary trading. Separately, there was an ABS correlation desk, which was located out of London. And one of the changes that I made when I joined Citi was to have that desk under Mickey, and the person who was responsible for that desk. The risk of the ABS correlation was reported under Mickey, and then unfortunately, you know, everything started to unravel. So that, you know, that acclimation didn't really fully take place because the market started to take a turn in January, and I really was on the desk, and you know, I started in June, but I really wasn't kind of up and running until September. I made the decision to have ABS correlation part of Mickey's credit correlation business because the market was becoming more developed, and a correlation trading desk, I think, should be run as a correlation trading desk. At least in those days, that was my opinion. But still within the same world that I had responsibility for, so there was communication between the two desks.
Again, a Citi question. If my memory serves me, Citi was highly ranked in CDOs, but in 2005, it was highly ranked then. Its business was really very much a cash business.
Yeah.
But in 2006, Michael Raines from Deutsche Bank, from derivatives powerhouse Deutsche Bank, arrives, and there's a ton more synthetic CDOs done.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. Well, you can talk to the people that hired me to get kind of a sense of why they hired me. I wasn't hired to push the synthetic ABS CDO business. It was very clear that that was not the case. The synthetic ABS CDO business was already gunning very quickly in terms of growth before I arrived. And that's because the ABS CDO business became really a synthetic ABS CDO business. And that was under Nestor's auspice. And that was just a product of the market. I was hired to grow the derivatives business within the corporate side, which is why I hired Mickey, who came from the corporate credit side, because credit correlation was viewed as very weak, and in fact, Citi had significant problems and were shut down because of OCC issues on the credit correlation book based on infrastructure deficiencies.
Huh.
And the single name trading at Citi was also viewed as a weak link within the fixed income division. So I was hired to focus my efforts on building that business, and in fact, 90% of the hires I made were on that side. CDO business, as you correctly point out, was number one. Nestor was viewed internally as one of the strongest senior managers And the CDO business was viewed as the golden goose within fixed income. It's very, very highly regarded. And, you know, it was important for me to have that as part of my responsibility. But there was no initiative that took place that was to grow the ABS CDO synthetic business. That is, you know, okay. It's a byproduct of the growth of the ABS market. I mean, okay. ABS CDOs became synthetic because that market had just opened up, and to continue to be a leader in ABS CDOs because of the efficiencies of synthetic ABS, you were able to ramp up ABS CDOs more quickly.
Right.
But it was not one of the initiatives that I had when I started. In fact, one of the issues that I had was to diversify our income stream away from ABS. And I made a number of senior presentations about emerging markets, growing leverage loans, although leverage loans were very strong at Citi. It was leverage loans and ABS in the CDO business. But diversifying our income stream away from traditional ABS CDOs.
You were there a short time, but on the corporate as opposed to the ABS side,
yeah.
did you actually grow that business significantly?
Yeah. I mean, it was you know, the first 6 months were hiring, and then, you know, we hired all the credit relations people. You know, a number of them are still there, which is which I'm thrilled about because they've done a great job and I think have been viewed as by current management as, you know, very qualified talent. Vicky and there's a guy named Fred Gillo, all of whom I hired, or they joined us, I should say, from Deutsche. But that's where the growth came from in that short period that I was there. But it was really from January till, you know, June and July is when the whole market really crapped out. But that's where the expectations were the greatest, growing that business. Because it was viewed that the ABS CDO market was becoming a mature market, and for growth to occur, we had to look at other pockets, other asset classes, within kind of the overall structured credit space. Commercial real estate was one, emerging market assets were one, and then obviously corporate credit and credit correlation was a significant one. And as I said, the 90% of the hires I made were in, even 95% were in the credit correlation space.
So wasn't corporate credit structured products, was that volume materially lower than
what I was
than ABS? Switching from Citi to overall market, do you have a sense of those?
Yeah, corporate credit, my sense is that, well, corporate synthetic, well, credit correlation was significantly lower at Citi than at all of its peer group. ABS, their CDOs was significantly greater from a revenue standpoint at Citi when I walked in the door. But corporate credit and leverage loan was significantly higher. So leverage loan and ABS were the two prizes of Citi's fixed income business. It really was viewed when I walked in as a significant success story. Over many, many years, that was a strategic decision that was made to build the CDO business, and those were the two biggest asset classes. But corporate credit is highly correlated. Corporate credit correlation is highly correlated to trading of single name credit default swaps. That was viewed as a weak component of Citi's fixed income franchise because Citi grew up as Salomon's cash bond house and was late to the party to the derivative side on corporate credit and didn't invest in the same technology that a lot of the European banks like Deutsche Bank invested in. So that didn't mature at the same level, and you know, there were significant senior level discussions of growing that corporate derivatives book and the correlation book, because the view was that Citi's derivative and corporate credit business was much weaker.
From Citi, just in terms of general size of the market, if you aggregated all the major players, is your sense that the corporate correlation business was larger or smaller in aggregate volume than sort of the ABS correlation or ABS CDO business?
Wait, say that one more time.
I'm trying to ask an overall market question rather than a Citi question. You've been wonderfully clear about Citi's objectives and where they were strong and weak. But from a market perspective, was the corporate correlation, you know, CSO, the corporate synthetic structured products business overall market larger or smaller than the ABS CDO?
Larger. It was a bigger pie, and we were smaller. Citi was a smaller player in that bigger pie. So the opportunity was greater, and where Citi was coming from was much weaker. So the what was communicated to me in terms of the reason for the hire was to build that business, and also to, because Citi had suffered versus its peers of derivative technology and infrastructure, and had all the issues with the OCC.
Okay. So I want to focus on market rather than on Citi. So this was a larger market, but what happened to that corporate credit structured products market from sort of 2003 to 2007?
It grew. I mean, there was a significant growth in the synthetic market for the synthetic trading of single names. So, and there were significant deals that were done, non-ABS deals, you know, CSOs that were done in that period of time. I think that the market experienced significant growth, and there were number of funds and investors that did very well during that period of time.
And that market was both single name and structured products, which were some portfolio structured tranched combination of names. If you compared just the structured products side rather than the single name side, I'm just trying to get a little more apples to apples.
Right.
If you did the structured corporate credit structured products and compared that to ABS CDOs, was the corporate market significantly larger?
My recollection during that period of time is that and that was a period of time I was at Deutsche, and I didn't have responsibility for the CSO market. So this is just being in London, which Deutsche was such a powerhouse within CSOs that market was significant and greater than the ABS CDO market. Because Deutsche made a strategic decision to, and this was coming out of Entrejane and out of London, to grow that, continue to invest in that market, meaning the trading of single name CDS. And I think one is so highly correlated with the other that I think it's meaning that to look at the growth of the CSO market, you have to look at the growth of the underlying credits, because one kind of follows the other. And that market, you know, from 2000 to 2007 grew exponentially.
Right.
And that was viewed as a significant target initiative for Deutsche Bank during that period of time, even though I didn't have responsibility for either the underlying credit trading and the CSO training. Frankly, at Deutsche Bank, I was part of the not the cool group. I was, you know, because Deutsche Bank really was focused in on that market, and I'm sure helped with my hiring at Citi because I came from such a strong corporate derivatives house. Firms make decisions in terms of what they invest their capital in. So that's my recollection.
So, and did that market, again, corporate credit, yeah, CSOs, single names, did that market experience large losses?
Well, there was the big hiccup in, I can't remember when it was, 2000, when a lot of correlation desks, and including Citi, I'm really blanking on it, but in like 2000, nothing compared to what we saw on the ABS side, but there was
2001?
Was it 2001?
I'm not sure.
I can't remember, but there was a hiccup which caused...
Did I miss the exciting part? I'll be right back.
Okay.
Just got you.
That caused market turmoil on the credit side. I wasn't involved in the market, but I do remember the event. I was in London, and losses were incurred by a number of firms, but you know, nothing compared to what firms sustained. And it was all based on credit correlation modeling. There was an issue with modeling credit correlation inappropriate kind of inputs. I was in London, so it had to have been between 2001 and 2005. And Citi, I wasn't at Citi either, and it's one of the reasons for them bringing me over was that it actually caused the credit correlation desk to shut down during that period of time.
In 07 and 08, were there significant losses in those products?
At Citi, no, there weren't. I mean, there were losses, but they were, in the scheme of significance, they were not significant.
I'm not necessarily.
No, I'm talking about
Citi's
losses. No, in my market, it was not
investor losses.
They were not. My understanding of the market during that period of time, and I left in 07, so I really haven't, you know, because I've been out of the market, I can't give you a great read because I've just been out of it since 07, the market, but you know, I think spreads were incredibly volatile, and when the market was trying to ascertain you know, pricing, and I think with volatility comes potential losses. Right. I mean, there. I'm sure with the bank stocks, you know, including Citi. I think credit default swaps on Citi, you know, blew out. So, you know, Citi exposure that you had in Citi credit default swap in one of those CSOs had to have led to at least mark-to-market losses, but I think that was more mark-to-market losses than realized losses on those tranches, is my guess.
It's interesting that the hiccup you referred to in the CSO market in the early 2000s, you say it was related to correlation modeling. Some are of the view that...
Can I ask your favor? Can I take a quick bath?
Yes,
water?
I'm okay. Sorry.
Okay.
Of course.
You know where it is.
Yeah. We are back on the record after taking a few-minute break, and
Ms. Norman has dropped off the phone.
And I am going to try to speed up a little in my list of questions, but we had been talking about the corporate credit market, structured products market, compared to the ABS CDO market. And just, I will confess, this is an issue that has interested me because it has, without seeing data, been my impression that this was a much larger market. When people talk about derivatives and structured products, you have this very large market that developed, that had some losses, but I think did not have the devastating losses that developed in the ABS CDO market. And all of this was somewhat happening simultaneously, and the technology that developed in the corporate area very much was adapted then to the ABS area. And just for the record, through my monologue here, which I'm not supposed to do, Michael's been nodding in agreement. So I find it interesting. And that's why we've continued a little bit in that area. But you were still at Deutsche Bank then when ABX was introduced.
Correct.
So that was January of 06, yes?
January of 06, and I left in
June.
June, yeah.
Right. So how did the development of ABX, in your view, change mortgage markets, change the CDO market?
Well, it was adapted, I believe, from a corporate precedent. I don't know what the corporate CDX, right. So, you know, I think it was originally viewed as a helpful tool, indices and trading on indices, both in the equity markets and the corporate markets, I think were generally viewed by market participants as a good thing. So the introduction of ABX was touted as a positive in the market, and to have expertise as a trading house to trade ABX was also viewed as a positive part of a trading book. But I didn't have primary responsibility for trading ABX at Citigroup. That was part of the securitization group.
And that was not Nestor's group.
That was
someone
Nestor's
else.
Group. Yes, it was under Perlowitz and Cesarski. They ran securitization at Citigroup. Didn't mean that he didn't trade ABX as a hedging tool, or he looked at ABX, but in terms of the market maker within Citi, you know, you can't have more than one market maker of a product, and that was under the auspice of the single name ABS traders, which made sense to have that as part of that world.
But did the development of having an index help the market grow, help the market crash, lead to greater trading volume? Any thoughts?
I don't think it helped market grow or crash. I think it was another data point that people viewed as a way to gauge a consortium of however many assets were in. I don't know if it was 30 or 50 or 80.
20.
It was a tool that made it easier to look at that consortium of credits as opposed to looking at the individual credits themselves, trading wise. So I don't think my opinion, didn't help the market grow or crash. It just was a helpful trading mechanism.
There was significant trading volume in ABX once it was introduced.
Right.
I had a sense actually that volume was larger than the traders had initially expected.
Yeah, I mean, I never looked at kind of monthly trading. I'm sure whoever put together the ABX put out monthly trading statistics, or maybe you can get your hands on those.
That's actually, trading volume is very difficult.
Very difficult. I mean, my guess would be that it helped the market grow, but an index, and again, I think there's it wasn't a novel idea to have an index on 20 credits. So historically, looking at whether it's Dow Jones index or that clearly has helped. You know, when stocks are dropped out of certain indices, their volume in those stocks does drop. So, you know, guessing that helped the market grow. But I guess at the time I didn't think it was a monumental development. I thought it was a sign of a more mature market that it was getting its own index. But I didn't think that, oh, this is going to lead to significant volumes, is my recollection of discussions of the ABX. I thought I viewed it as a positive for the market in terms of transparency on both sides, and that investors could take different positions on either side of that index, buying or selling protection.
For the development of correlation trading, did you view that? There are competing understandings of the drivers of that. There's one story that is investors call up and say, I want to take a view on X, Y, or Z with these specs. Another view is that a desk has positions that it wants to go long or short in different fashions for different reasons, and it's sort of beating the drum trying to attract that investor interest.
I mean, my view is the former, that correlation was a way, and this is coming from my Deutsche Bank days, and specifically credit correlation, was a way that if an investor called up and said they wanted to take, you know, the 3-5% risk on a basket of 100 corporate credits that were all in the telecom industry, I'm just making that up, you could create a bespoke pool of credits and meet that investor demand. And that was the benefit of correlation, and then using correlation methodology to then appropriately hedge what you were retaining to create that bespoke tranche. So you know, bankers and traders and marketers on Wall Street were delivering a product that would meet. I think the key thing from our perspective, I'm sure from when you worked at Bear, was, you know, meeting investor demand and then creating, understanding what the investor was looking for. And this was a mechanism to enable a desk to immediately meet that investor demand. So I was more the former camp in terms of at least the genesis of growth and correlation desks.
And would those investors who called up generally be hedge funds, or who would they
be? Hedge funds,
were they?
Banks. You know, there was a growth in what was called the levered super senior, which was, you know, above AAA, the first of 3%. That was a lot of conduits. They had spread bogeys that they needed to meet.
And was leveraged super senior generally corporate credit?
It was generally corporate, but then it was also an asset back. Not as big an asset back, but mainly corporate credits. And it was a super senior that was then carved up and retained the rating, and it was someone who, it was an investor who wanted to get a, if the whole super senior was trading at LIBOR plus 5, you could lever the first three notches and have that trade at LIBOR. It was 10-1 leverage. They could get a 50 basis point over LIBOR return, and a leveraged super senior allowed that investor to meet that return hurdle. And that would have been a could have been a bank or a conduit. And I think primarily with banks and conduits, not hedge funds, because it wasn't attractive enough for the hedge funds.
My sense for the leveraged super seniors is the rating agencies actually had a significant role in generating interest in the product. My anecdotal experience is that they were pitching that product to the market more than bankers.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was because Bear was not pitching that product.
Well, I think you had to have a correlation desk. Did Bear have a correlation desk?
Corporate.
Right, but I mean...
Corporate they did.
Right. So...
I may just not have been aware. That was
right.
Different.
I wasn't close enough, because the growth of that was when I was at Deutsche Bank in London, and I wasn't close enough to the the what was going on, but, you know, it wouldn't surprise me.
Again, differing views. They're asking for your opinion. Some people would suggest that additional synthetic supply leads to creating additional demand for cash products, because it generates interest in the space. And others would argue, no, it's satisfying demand, so it's not leading to additional net demand for cash CDO. So allowing me to restate this is more in the ABS CDO space. Did the development of synthetics generate greater interest, so it kept the cash market going as well? Or did it supplant the cash market and satisfy the demand?
The latter. I think it was... my opinion is that a market has to be demand-driven, not supply-driven. You can't... You're responding to investor demand, and the synthetic product enabled you to meet that demand more efficiently, because you didn't have to warehouse the cash assets for as long a period of time. So, if anything, it was viewed as a positive, because banks didn't have to wear the risk for, you know, a longer period of time and acquire the assets. They could structure and place a CDO meeting that demand much quicker. Which was a good thing, both from the investor standpoint and from the bank standpoint. And if investors had demand, they typically wouldn't want to wait 9 months to satisfy that demand. So I would, you know, I would argue it was demand driven.
So if you consistent with your view that this is investor demand driven, you discount then the efforts of bankers and marketers to educate what they view as educate investors as to new products and new ways of investing and trading strategies. I mean, there's a whole series of people.
No, I agree. I mean, I'm not discounting that. I think that, you know, there was significant appetite for asset-backed product, the underlying core asset, because it the spreads were cheaper than corporate product, and investors understood it easier than a leveraged loan product, and banks were able to meet that demand by creating structures that, if an investor wanted to take more risk or less risk, they could structure different tranches within that same core asset, whether it's equity or super senior. And the attributes of the CDO manager, that you had a third party managing those assets, whether or not that ended up being true or not, was something that was also very appealing to investors. But you know, there's no question that banks played a role in marketing the product, like you know, banks traditionally do in the growth of any capital markets instrument. But I do think you have to have the demand from the investor to invest the capital and the time and the effort to create products. And you know, going back to the credit card analogy, but the securitization structure has been such a successful structure for 30 years, you know, coming from the mortgage market in the 70s. So that was something that I think everyone looked to as, okay, you can take an asset, you can tranche an asset, and, you know, coming from that same asset, you can offer, depending upon your ratings and your risk appetite and your spread bogey, different pieces of the same asset structured up and down the capital structure.
So, before we broke, took a break, we were actually starting to talk about credit correlation modeling. So I do want to go back to that. So in CSOs, there was a problem in that marketplace, and some investors or underwriters took some losses because they had been modeling credit correlation inappropriately. A critique of the ABS CDO market can rest on, as you suggested, the poor underwriting of the mortgages themselves, could rest on inaccurate rating of the mortgage-backed securities, as actually Nestor commented about this, that he felt things that were rated AA in the end were really should have only been single B. Or third could rest on an inaccurate understanding of correlation of mortgage assets, which, if that is the case, would be ironic that there had been an earlier problem with correlation that perhaps got fixed, but then was perhaps repeated, and repeated on a radically larger scale in the ABS CDO market. So do you have any views on that?
Well, I think the third one, maybe I'm not explaining it well. The credit correlation blip was based on it models that, you know, what a credit correlation book and the way that it's run is that you can sell one tranche and then you hedge what you retain. And that's based upon a number of complicated models. You can't hedge dollar for dollar, but you hedge different corporate credits that are correlated to other corporate credits, and under the terms of that model, it's supposed to show a result where you quote-unquote are hedged. That's the basis of credit correlation. The models that a number of the firms were using when that happened, and again, I wasn't responsible for that at Deutsche Bank, there was an error in some of those assumptions.
So it was in their own hedging.
It was their own hedging that there was an error. And then the numbers were
okay.
Insignificant in terms of the scheme of what's happened here. The losses sustained by all the firms in the industry was not based on correlation models. It was based on, I think, what kind of your second point and the first point, which is that, and maybe the ratings were inappropriate, that someone thought and believed and marketed and structured and sold an asset that they believed in earnest to be AAA or BBB, and in fact they were BB or single B. So that's a very different set of circumstances, and which is you know where I guess my initial comment is that you can take something and even you know securitization of a bankrupt company like Federated and structure AAA as long as you understand what that and the rating agencies rate that cash flow stream. The premise of securitization is you can you know create then a set of different tranches, but if that asset was underwritten inappropriately or fraudulently or what have you, and it really was not something that was a AAA asset or even a BBB asset because a lot of those loans were not underwritten by the same standards that were communicated to the rating agencies. And the rating agencies then, you know, rate all three rating agencies rated those assets. Not just one agency, but all three rating agencies rated those assets, you know, based upon information that they were fed by the underlying mortgage originators and issuers. That, you know, that then, you know, trickles through this machine, which is, you know, what the securitization and then the CDOs of those securitizations. So it's securitization will not magically fix something that's already tainted. So I think that kind of your summary of the three components, I would disagree with the last because I don't, correlation is not what caused the issue. And the correlation that caused the issue was even if the scale was much larger, it was a very different set of circumstances that created those losses than the first two that you described.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. I now agree that the analogy I was trying to draw is wrong, but I want to come back to the correlation
okay.
with a reformulated correlation point. So I think what you were saying was that the underwriters who in the early 2000s lost money because they had with improper models had improperly hedged their exposure, that is not what occurred in 2007-2008.
Right.
I agree. Nonetheless, the ABS CDO methodology depends first on accurate ratings of the underlying collateral, and then secondly on an assumption as to whether that collateral will perform in sync or perform in a diversified fashion. So I use correlation as that concept. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest that there was some presumption that BBB subprime securities were assumed not to all perform similarly when they were packaged into ABS CDOs. And as it turns out, they largely did perform similarly and very poorly. So that the assumption related to the correlation among the lower rated tranches or subordinate tranches of subprime was at a minimum underestimated.
Yeah,
would you
that's
agree?
Interesting. I see what you're saying. I the correlation issues with the corporate sector were, you know, telecoms go under, then what happens to you know, it was two completely different, or four or five completely different industries, and that correlation was you know, didn't, it, you know, that disaster scenario of whatever industry caused that crisis had a bigger impact on spreads of the other bonds that were in that synthetic CSO. I don't, you know, in my opinion, I don't think anyone who, and I could be wrong, who bought an ABS CDO thought that there was this broad diversity of mortgage subprime originators. And my recollection of ABX was that it was it was all very similarly situated issuers that were issuing triple B bonds. That it wasn't, you know, first of all, 20 credits is not a very broad index. It's not like Dow Jones where you have healthcare and banks. And my recollection it wasn't sold as a diversified basket of credits that would withstand, you know, a downturn in, you know, differently underwritten subprime mortgages. I mean, maybe a geographic distribution was something that, you know, was clearly taken into account. But the diversity of credits was not something that I would have thought was part of the attribute of the CDO.
Then why did the market accept that you could take a pool of triple B subprime tranches and create 70-80% triple A?
Well, I think there was a view in the market that a CDO manager, of all the product that was coming through the system, that someone who didn't have the time or the credit expertise or the wherewithal to go through each of those 70 credits could hire a manager and pay that manager a management fee to pick out what they perceive to be the best of the, you know, of all the credits. And the best of all the credits could have been in the same space, but some people were doing it better than other people were doing it. Turns out that the entire market was doing it inappropriately, and you know, we had this margin mortgage meltdown, which impacted everyone, whether you were City Mortgage or you were Fremont Mortgage. I mean, everyone got hit by the same brush, which was, you know, the unfortunate outcome. But there was a benefit ascribed to a CDO in that you had an independent manager kind of selecting those credits across a broad, you know, geographic distribution. And, you know, there had to have been some benefit, you're right, ascribed to diversity of credits. But I don't know if that was... I don't know if that was kind of the strong selling point. Similar to a CLO, I mean, there have been very few kitchen sink, if you will, CDOs where you have asset-backed and leveraged loans and and investment-grade credits. And the reason for that, in my opinion, and it's been tested in the market, at least in the last 10 years, is that you want someone who's in a particular space, like the CLO space, that's going to cull through the best credits, going to have the access to the best deals in the new issue market. But if the entire leveraged loan market, which it, you know, obviously did have major hiccups, nothing like the subprime mortgage market, you would get, especially if you were a lower rated participant, you would be impacted by the downturn in the leveraged loan market. So it's obviously a good question to ask the investors who invested in this. Do they think they were buying, you know, highly, you know, rated tranches, and they didn't know it was all triple B tranches? I would be surprised if that was their take on it.
Well, did you interact with investors? What do you think their view was?
Only when there were problems, unfortunately. I think that investors, were looking at, you know, they had to have a view on the subprime market, and their view on the subprime market was bullish, and that home ownership in the U.S. has and real estate prices, you know, had continued to rise year after year, and their view is that if a homeowner is going to default, they're going to default on their credit card, which is an absolute unsecured piece of paper versus the house they live in. And they didn't understand the, you know, the CLO and the leveraged loan market was a tight club of, you know, a small number of our participants, and the ABS, subprime ABS CDO market offered them the opportunity to get more spread than other structured credit markets, and in an asset class that they perceive to be, you know, a positive asset class.
Starting in 2005 and 2006, there were warning mm-hmm. signs. There were some, at least, who were saying housing prices aren't going to continue to appreciate, or they're going to decline somewhat. Housing's getting less affordable. You know, all the reset rates are going to hit. People are going to have trouble. Why was everyone still so bullish in 2006?
I guess I should preface my comments. I mean, that was the overall sentiment of, I think, why the ABS CDO market grew, because of a general bullish attitude. I think clearly there were, you know, people and parties and investors that felt as though there were signs of significant weakness. But there were enough investors who said, you know what, there are signs of significant weakness and spreads have widened, it's a good time to buy. You know, market is, everyone, you know, people now look back and they say, well, it's so obvious, but any market, you see dips and increases, and you know, I heard as much bullish sentiment as negative sentiment that it's the U.S. housing market, and you know, this is going to continue to increase, and maybe I won't buy the single Bs or double Bs, but there's still value in the AAAs, and AAAs have widened out by 30 basis points, and I can't get that. If I'm a money manager or asset manager and I'm being measured on my performance, I can't get that in AAA land in any other market because spreads were grinding in. And then, you know, the numbers, personal consumption, I mean, consumer confidence, GDP, all those, all the non-housing data, if you look at that period of time, were very strong. So, again, I think it's easy to look back and say, oh, everyone should have known this thing was going to crater. But if you look at all, like, consumer confidence was very, very high. And I remember at Citi looking at those numbers. So I think the deals were, I think that there was less bullish sentiment, there's no question. But I think what the big question for all of us, and you know, is timing. It happened so quickly. And how did that happen so quickly? That I can't get, you know, I have no answer for. Because, you know, markets can turn, but I think that the market turns so quickly that it's a very hard, it's a very hard thing to get your arms around. Right?
Not interested in New Orleans conversation. Sorry. Or the silt. We paused so that I could review my notes and check that I've asked all the myriad questions that I want to grill Michael about. A couple, and we'll wrap up. We touched on this before, but I want to ask it more directly. Do you think, in some way, CDS, you know, pay-as-you-go swaps, or ABX, or other derivative developments, help burst the housing bubble?
I think it had an impact on the housing bubble, but it's not a yes or no answer. So sorry.
That's fine.
But I think that if you didn't have the issue here at origination, if you didn't have that, then none of those developments would have had, it would not have been a burst, because each of those have precedence in other markets where you didn't have the same problems on the underlying source of assets and didn't create a bubble.
trying to be precise in answering my questions, I accept that it's your view that the core of the problem was poorly underwritten mortgages. Nonetheless, there is a question of did derivatives contribute an increase in some way price transparency, increase in some way the visibility of those who had negative views, and did when ABX suffered a significant decline, would you say that that was part of the popping of the bubble and the ending of the bullish expansion?
Mm-hmm.
That is one point of view.
I mean, I guess I'm just trying to think, if you didn't have ABX and you didn't know, maybe it went into the timing issue I just alluded to. So if you didn't have efficient markets, meaning kind of transparent markets, would that have delayed the onslaught of this panic that ensued? Maybe. I mean, I'm thinking if everything was over the counter and there was no way for the market to see sentiment, does that information help speed up an issue? I think it helps speed up an issue because people can see on a screen that there are more bears than bulls. Just like when a stock market starts to fall, if you didn't have that public dissemination of where the Dow Jones was and people didn't start to panic and start selling more, that does probably exacerbate an underlying issue. So I would say it did have an impact.